Thanks for coming. I'm going to be talking about drag fluids and superfluids today, and specifically about the effect of quantum fluctuations on drag fluids and superfluids. So that's how I'm going to try to make a connection with people here at this conference. And before I go on, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators. Yves Pomeau and I got interested in this problem a few years ago, and we made some progress then. And then recently, last year, a very talented graduate student named Andrew Sykes from University of Queensland came to visit me at Los Alamos, and we made some more progress, and I'll be presenting some of our results. And also Matt Davis and I have been collaborating on the numerics. So what makes superfluids super? So this is my artistic ability. This is why I'm a physicist and not an artist. So this is the cartoon picture of at least what the orthodox view of superfluidity is. So this sword-like object is supposed to be a spaceship with some initial velocity. And the idea is that if you give some object some initial velocity in any fluid, eventually it'll come to a stop and just ignore gravity from Earth. And if you imagine that you're in some atmosphere or something, an object moves, the air particles will bounce off, you'll exchange some momentum, and eventually the initial energy from your object will be transferred to the heating of the fluid. And of course, even in dilute deep space, which the first approximation is frictionless, there's a little bit of stuff out there, intergalactic medium and stuff, so eventually it'll come to a stop. But the amazing thing about superfluids is that at least the orthodox view of superfluids, at least some people see as the orthodox view of the superfluids, is that even in a dense superfluid like liquid helium, if you give an object an initial velocity small enough, smaller than some critical velocity, which is on the order of the speed of sound, that it will go on forever. That there's not a little drag force, there's actually zero drag force. And this is what I'm going to argue with today. And what I'm going to argue is that if you introduce quantum fluctuations of the superfluid medium, that this will change this picture, and it'll actually give a little bit of drag force at all velocities. So just to remind, again, what I'm talking about, it's a very simple problem. I have an object in a slow-moving superfluid, and I'll describe what I mean by superfluid in here in a few slides. But I have an object in a slow-moving superfluid. I'm going to introduce quantum fluctuations, and I'm going to ask a simple question, is there a drag force on this object or not? So here's my outline. I'm going to remind you what superfluid it is, why we care about such an obscure problem. Go through a little bit of the theoretical history on this problem, what has been done, and then introduce quantum fluctuations in this problem and show how that modifies this picture. So superfluidity. So it was discovered by, now I'm being taped. I shouldn't have put Kapitsa. I should have put Kapitsa, Allen, and Meissner. So it's a bit controversial who was the first person to discover it. Depends if there's Russians in the audience or not, or English, but it was co-discovered by Kapitsa and Allen and Meissner in 1938. There was this idea of frictionless flow through porous media that they first saw, and it was first coined by Kapitsa. And it's interested many great minds of the 20th century, lots of Nobel Prizes and so forth. And the reason why it's been so interesting, it's still after 60, 70 years after its discovery, is this one of the few systems where its quantum mechanics is really apparent on a macroscopic scale, and I'll describe what I mean by that. And there's also many applications. I list a few here: superconductivity, atomic lasers, which is going to be something that's going to be more related to the stuff that I talk about in this talk. So I'm not going to define exactly what I mean by superfluidity. It's actually quite a subtle concept, and I'm just going to go by Tony Leggett's formalism and just sort of as this collection of phenomena. But this is at least motivated by a lot of the superfluid helium experiments. You have a new sound mode, this temperature wave, the second sound mode that comes in. You have below this lambda temperature, you have this effective, almost infinite thermoconductivity, so it stops boiling. And perhaps one of the most dramatic consequences of superfluidity is that they're irrotational. You can't rotate them unless you have these singularities and these vortices. And this is the direct connection with quantum mechanics, because these singularities are quantized. The circulation is quantized in terms of h bar over m. And then you have this you had this idea of persistent currents that was that had been seen in superconductors for quite a while, and it was also seen in liquid helium in the 1960s by John Reppe, and it's just recently been seen in these new dilute condensates. So let me just briefly describe at least a theorist view of what persistent currents are. So just imagine I have, this is one of the few experiments I've done in my career. That, so imagine you have a coffee cup, and I spin this coffee cup, and I keep spinning it, and so the coffee is going to spin with it because of the friction of the coffee and the object. And so, and then if I stop the coffee cup, of course, the fluid will eventually come to a stop, right? So now let's imagine that I have normal fluid helium. I have liquid helium above the critical temperature. And I do the same thing. I start spinning this bucket, and it'll the normal fluid will start to spin with the bucket, and then I cool it below this critical temperature, and now I stop the bucket. And what Reppe saw was that the fluid will continue for almost ever. I think he did it up to like 12 hours or something with no noticeable decay. So 12 hours is pretty long on atomic timescales. So these persistent currents last for a very long time, and this is something that I'm going to definitely need to explain at the end of this talk, because I'm going to be arguing that there's going to be a drag force because of quantum fluctuations at any speed. And I'm going to show that this is actually consistent with these experimental observations of persistent currents, or at least argue that it's consistent. Okay, so shortly after Kapitsa and Allen and Meissner's discovery, Landau came out with one of the great papers in physics of the 20th century, 1941, and explained a lot of these phenomena I just showed you of superfluidity. And one of the things that he explained was this idea of frictionless flow below a certain critical velocity. And he had this very powerful argument. He didn't assume any quantum statistics or anything like that. He proposed this dispersion relation, and then he argued roughly as following: if you have a container of superfluidity, say at zero temperature, and you Galilean transform this container at a certain speed relative to the fluid, he argued that because of this dispersion relation, you cannot create excitations unless you're above a certain speed. Below a certain speed, you would not be able to create any of the low-lying collective excitations. And because, and as a crucial assumption, and he's a very smart guy, he stated explicitly in his paper, if you assume that the only way that you can dissipate energy is by the creation of excitations, which seems pretty reasonable, then you have a critical velocity below which this flow will flow without friction. And so this was a very powerful argument, and I want to emphasize this is something that I'm not arguing against. I mean, I would be in lots of trouble, and people seem to get very angry when I give this talk a lot of times because they think I'm somehow violating God or Landau or something, or the same. But this argument, of course, holds. It's if you create excitations, you need a certain critical velocity. What I'll be arguing is that even at zero temperature, there's underlying quantum fluctuations that can scatter from the object. And even if you don't create excitations, they can cause a bit of drag force.
Does the Rotor minimum correctly reproduce the experimental EC?
No, it doesn't. It's actually like an order of magnitude off. And the typical explanation for that is because you have nonlinear effects, you have vortex shedding. In fact, I think it was by Langer here that was first proposed this. So even though this critical velocity, he had the rough idea, right? There is some critical velocity that they seem to see in experiments, but the critical velocity is about an order of magnitude off in liquid helium. It depends on the experiment you do. They've done critical velocity experiments in condensates, and it's a bit closer. But it's always complicated due to these vortex shedding, or in one dimension, there's soliton shedding phenomenon stuff. I'll mention this briefly later. And perhaps I should mention this too while we're here. So Landau did not assume any Bose statistics or anything in his argument. And I'm not sure exactly the reason why that was so. It was very controversial at the time. There was lots of infighting between the physicists. If you want to read the history of the discovery of this, Sebastian Balibar wrote a really good article on this last year. about the pettiness of academic politics back then. But I think one of the big reasons why people didn't, although London, Fritz London proposed that condensation, Bose-Einstein condensation was intimately related with this, a lot of people disregarded it at the beginning because this idea of Bose-Einstein condensation, which I have here, was, I'll just remind you what this is that Bose, as I'm sure you all know this, this is what we learned in undergrad, Bose has proposed these new counting statistics for photons because they're truly identical in a quantum mechanical sense. Einstein applied these to atoms and showed that there's a phase transition at low enough temperature where atoms will collapse down to the zero momentum state and a macroscopic number of atoms can congregate there. But I think Einstein, in one of his letters, if I remember correctly, assumed that this was just an artifact of the perfect gas, of the non-interacting gas. And so I don't think a lot of people really thought this was going to be seen in a realistic environment. And it wasn't until Bogoliubov in 1947 who showed that if you have a weakly interacting gas, that you can still maintain the condensate properties, and with a depletion of this condensate, but you'll have a macroscopic number of particles. And this, and Bogoliubov showed in a really great paper that the dispersion relation at low momenta is phonon-like, if you allow for weak interactions among particles. And of course, if there's no interactions, it would just be k squared.
The excitation is typical for any, say, simple liquid. The difference, great difference, superfluidic and just like phonon rotor modes in argon, any. The difference in this case in superfluid, your excitation, no broadening of this excitation, so it's no imaginary part, it's only real part, omega as a function of Q you're showing here. This is the difference, because such kind of phonon proton absorption any
right. So I mean, I didn't mean to imply that this is gives. I guess the implication that you're arguing with is that this is a necessary condition for superfluidity, and I didn't mean to imply that. So that's correct. So, And this is this idea that after the condensation was seen in 95, where all these particles were congregated, this macroscopic number of particles in a single quantum state was shown in this, as all these soldiers marching in lockstep with all these other soldiers. These are thermal atoms, and these are the condensate atoms. I thought it was a cool picture. So I'm going to be, even though that I've talked about mostly liquid helium so far, I'm going to be talking primarily about these new dilute condensate systems and alkali atomic gases. And there's many reasons why these are nicer systems, both theoretically and experimentally, to deal with than liquid helium. And it's all related to this, well, at least theoretically it's related because they're dilute. If they're dilute, we have a small parameter, and we can write a Hamiltonian with some degree of confidence and calculate things from first principles. So that's one of the major motivations for the theorists. And it's just interesting to note that in liquid helium, they first saw the superfluid properties in 1938, but it was controversial. I don't think it was actually the condensate underlying superfluid liquid helium wasn't actually seen conclusively until the 80s from evaporation experiments and neutron scattering. Whereas in these dilute condensates, the condensate, which was much more apparent, as you can see here, this is a time of flight image, and this is this k equals zero mode, was apparent right from the beginning, but the superfluid properties were harder to extract. But since they've discovered that they've had various experiments where they've seen superfluid properties, quantized vortices, this idea of dissipationless flow, and so forth. And another big difference is there are about roughly 10% of the atoms in the condensate and liquid helium, and almost all the atoms, or at least at zero temperature, are in this condensate. And this zero temperature really means very close to zero temperature. This is nanokelvin's very easy for these people, and I think Ketterle claims he can get down to picokelvin or something. So this is the coldest temperature, I think, in the universe. So, these were first discovered in '95 by Eric Cornell and Carl Wieman. and shortly thereafter by Kettley. They were awarded a Nobel Prize a few years after that. There's lots of applications. It's still a very active field. There's applications in quantum computing and quantum simulations of exotic materials and atomic lasers and so forth. As I mentioned, what will concern us here, at least theoretically, these are much nicer systems because we have a small diluteness parameter and we can expand around this in a controlled way. Also, experimentally, there's lots of advantages, namely that they can actually tune the interactions in these systems. So through Fischbach resonances, they can actually, to first approximation, turn the interactions off. They can go from repulsive to attractive interactions. These experiments are amazing. They can make almost any geometry you want now. They just made toroidal geometries and seen persistent currents, and they can do lots of nice things, whereas liquid helium, you're sort of stuck with what nature gave you. So again, just before I give you a flavor of the theory, just to remind you, we're dealing with a very simple problem here. We have an object and a slow-moving superfluid, and we want to figure out if there's a drag force on this object or not. Okay. So so this is a very general formula. It doesn't really, just to introduce to you what I mean by force. So I'm going to define all this in later slides now, but just to give you an idea, these bosonic field operators are these Galilean transformed. It's describing this Galilean transformed superfluid, and the object is going to be described by an external potential. Makes it much easier for this, as you'll see. It's an effective scattering problem, and so we're going to compute this quantity. We're going to make approximations to this field operator. We're going to compute this quantity, and we're going to ask whether there's a drag force here or not. And so, the first approximation, at least in these dilute condensate experiments, you can approximate this quantum field operator by this classical field. And this classical field's behavior is determined, at least in this field, is called the Gross-Piedersky equation, but this is just the nonlinear Schrodinger equation for the optics people in the audience. So and this is the steady state GP. So and so now we have a well-defined problem. We have a field. We have a field equation. We have a well-defined observable that we want to compute, and this is basically can be from a Madelung transformation can be transformed into an ideal fluid. This can be seen in terms of Bernoulli equations and so forth. And this simple problem here, this GP and this force, have been studied by many people. We've actually the Gross-Piedersky equation was actually quite popular even before they discovered these condensates, because this was seen as a model superfluid for liquid helium, even though that it doesn't describe liquid helium because it's only really true in the dilute approximation. But so people were, I think, basically started with Eve in the early 90s. And there's been many people after this. These are just a taste of some of the results. And they see all these types of effects that I briefly mentioned earlier, these vortex sheddings and all these things above a critical velocity. But what we'll be concerned with here, we're only concerned with very, very slow speeds. And so what they all saw is at some slow speed, there's a critical velocity that's non-trivial. Depends on the geometry and so forth. But at some slow enough speeds, they saw zero drag, no dissipation. So at least a first approximation, this verified Landau's picture. Even though that there are some complicating effects that affects the actual value of this critical speed, if you get slow enough speeds, there was some regime where there was no drag. And so
what kind of geometry?
Oh, just about every geometry you can imagine. So what the first geometries they were doing 2D geometries with a cylinder. And they saw the vortex sheddings after this. Since then, I believe Charles Adams and McCann from the University of Durham did a sphere in 3D. This was to I believe that they did a 3D. Because this was Kettley did an experiment where he was trying to test this in these dilute condensates. So there was lots of numerical versions of these Gross-Piedersky equations. But everybody is always concerned about I mean, the two questions they were really concerned about is, what is the critical velocity? What determines that? And that was geometry dependent. And what happens after this? And usually, cool things like vortices come out, or in one dimension.
They solve the dynamical equation or a steady state solution?
So they would have to solve the dynamical equation above the critical velocity, because you have this dynamics happening in these vortex shedding. Below a critical velocity, you can show that if there was no drag, that you can actually have a steady state. And perhaps the best example of this was this Vincent Akeem paper in 97. He solved this 1D problem exactly, and basically what he was doing is at slow enough speeds, you have an object moving. Say if you have a delta function moving in your GP fluid, at slow enough speeds, you can basically fit two solitons together in such a way to exactly mimic the boundary conditions from this delta function. But above a certain critical speed, this no longer works, and you can show that there's soliton sheddings. So it's this same analogy to vortex sheddings.
1D.
And 1D in the sense of you mean experimentally?
Theoretically,
just meaning that this is 1D as exactly what you would expect. This is this. Right. So experimentally, what they can do to mimic this idea of 1D, it's not actually 1D. It would be more like quasi 1D. What they can do is like these cigar-shaped condensates.
So finite-sized wire.
Yeah. Like finite-sized wire. Exactly. So there is no condensation in true 1D. This is like Liebig-Linegar gas. This is not what they're doing. They weren't doing Liebig-Linegar, and so they would do 1D Gospodarevsky equation, and they can solve that, and then. And in higher dimensions, a lot of this work is numerical. I mean, this Eve work is numerical, and a lot of this stuff is numerical. But again, the most important point is that there is some critical velocity, and it basically, as I mentioned here, they've seen over and over again, it's not the bulk fluid velocity that you have to compare to Landau's velocity. It's the maximum local fluid velocity. So if you have a cylinder in a flow or something, the maximum fluid velocity is going to be close to the cylinder. We all know this from undergrad physics, right? And so it's that velocity that you're going to have to compare with this Landau velocity. And when you exceed that, that's when you start shedding vortices and all these nonlinear effects come out. And this has actually been, this is not so surprising that you get a zero drag. This has been known for a couple hundred years now, and this is effectively an ideal fluid. If you transform this Gospodarevsky equation through this Madelung transformation, you can effectively make this to a classical ideal fluid with a funny quantum pressure term that doesn't really affect things too much. And so in this ideal fluid, people noticed a couple hundred years ago that there was no drag, and this was a paradox, and this bothered a lot of people, because if you put a rock in a stream, you know, it typically moved, so they knew there was a drag. So this bothered. This was a big controversy in fluid mechanics for a long time, and I don't think it was really effectively resolved until boundary layers were introduced and stuff early this century. Okay, so that is sort of what's been done, and this is just a flavor of the field. People have done this in many different geometries and so forth. So now we're going to add quantum fluctuations, and I know people use this word in many different contexts. So I'm going to define exactly what I mean here in a few slides. But the rough idea is that we have this quantum field operator that I said to first approximation is a very good approximation. You can assume that it's this classical field obeying this Gospodarevsky equation. And this works extremely well for these condensate experiments. They can see lots of observables, and with no fitting parameters, they can predict lots of things in these experiments. And now we can add this small in the sense of this diluteness parameter. This is our small parameter quantum fluctuating operator. And so this small operator has some observable consequences. I've listed a few here that they've seen in experiments. It's not so interesting because it's usually just a small correction. Well, it's not so interesting. It's interesting to the people who did it, but I mean, it's usually a small correction to this large condensate field. But this drag force, I'm going to argue, is the dominant term, right? Because I've just argued that there is no drag at subcritical speeds coming from this condensate. So if there's any drag at all coming from these fluctuations, no matter how small it is, it'll be the dominant term. Right?
But what is the source of fluctuations? This is still at zero temperature.
This is still at zero temperature. I'm going to introduce the Hamiltonian here in a second. So. So this is an aside for usually the superfluid people. I mean, you guys could probably tell me better than this. But just to remind you, and just to try to make a connection with quantum fluctuations in the Casimir argument, is that the Casimir argument, as we all know, is you have two mirrors or two perfect conductors in a vacuum. And restricts your quantum fluctuating modes between your mirrors, and then if you compute the energy densities inside and out, you can show that there is going to be some attractive force. This was his very nice argument in the 40s. So let's try to mimic this experiment. This is an aside. This is not drag. This is an aside. But let's try to mimic this Casimir argument in the condensate. So instead of conductors in a vacuum, let's have two infinitely thin, infinitely repulsive walls immersed into an infinitely extended condensate. Can you tell I'm a theorist? You know, so lots of infants. But we're going to have, but it's going to be very much immersed in this fluid, right? So if it's a classical fluid, if we're just doing classical effects, there should be no force on this object because there's the pressure of the fluid is equal on both sides. But we can show that if you introduce these quantum fluctuations, I'm sorry, I'll introduce this on the next slide exactly what I mean by these, that you'll have the identical, almost identical force, and this is not a thermal fluctuating Casimir force. This is really a quantum effect. And you can see that the force is actually the same basic expression as the original Casimir argument, and it's easy to see why is because it's dominated by the low K part of the energy spectrum, which is just phonon-like, which is very similar, it's identical to the electromagnetic case. So the only difference is the speed of light, the speed of sound, and some factor of two because of the polarizations. So this makes it, of course, a lot smaller. And I went up to an experimentalist and asked if they could do this once, and they had a good laugh, you know, and that's okay. You know. So in principle, they could do this, you know, so, but this would be a very, very, very difficult experiment. So before I confuse the issue, and although I'm trying to make this electromagnetic analogy, there's no analogy in the drag case, right? Because if we had a particle moving in an electromagnetic vacuum and there was a drag, we'd be in lots of trouble because we just broke the Lorentz invariance of the vacuum, right? So there's no direct electromagnetic analogy. The only way you could get a drag in the electromagnetic case is if you had something setting a frame. So if you had like a plate setting a frame, and then you can move something across this plate and get a drag. But I'm just having a single object moving a condensate. But that's okay in a condensate because I have a preferred frame. It's just a bucket of fluid. So there's a preferred frame there. So a drag force doesn't violate any fundamental laws. It doesn't mean that there's necessarily going to be one there, but just to not confuse the electromagnetic analogy. So, okay, so we can expand out this force in terms of this fluctuating operator. And so what do I mean by these fluctuations? So If we generalize Bogoliubov's argument of 47, so Bogoliubov had this argument that you have a Hamiltonian that describes weakly interacting Bose particles, and he did this canonical transformation. And if you do this canonical transformation in such a way, we have a non-uniform case. So these we're going to expand these quantum fluctuating operators in terms of these quasi-particle amplitudes and these quasi-particle operators. So what we're doing is we're transforming a Hamiltonian that describes a weakly interacting system into a system of non-interacting quasi-particles. And when we do this, and at zero temperature, you get this extra term here when you normal order these operators. So at zero temperature, you just have no excitations, and so the part you have remaining is what I'm referring to as the quantum fluctuations. In this field, in the superfluids, it's usually referred as the quantum depletion of the condensate. And this term was actually first computed, I believe it was first computed by Li and Yang in the 50s and 60s. And it was shown that it gives a correction to the ground state energy on the order of this diluteness parameter. So it's not so simple as just straightforward perturbation theory, because this small parameter is non-analytic. So you sort of have to self-consistently show that it's small. But so this is the term that I was talking about in this thought experiment that would give this attractive force, right? And these two walls. And these are the types of terms that I'm going to argue that are scattered. So for this transformation to happen, for this Hamiltonian.
I mean, in the thought experiment, you have boundary conditions.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Right? Your superfluid order parameter was zero on the two plates.
Right. So how is this an analogy with the drag force? Okay, so maybe it was a loose analogy. So the what we have here is we have an object. And it's going to be an effective scattering problem. So our object is going to be an external potential in this Galilean transform flow. And so we're not imposing boundary conditions to mimic this object. We're really imposing an external potential. And these equations here, these Bogle-Bodegin equations, are the equations that must be obeyed for this transformation to occur from this weakly interacting Hamiltonian to this non-interacting Hamiltonian. And so this sets up this effective scattering problem around this external potential. So this is not an equilibrium argument. This, you know, a drag force, of course, by definition can't be, right? So we have an effective scattering problem that we need to solve. So we have an object. Our incident waves are assumed to be coming in from the non-perturbed fluid, right? So it's just the Galilean transformed homogeneous fluid. And then we have to compute the scattered part of these of the scattered waves that is defined by this these equations here. These are two second order coupled PDEs, which means you have four modes in your scattering problem. And this would be the exact same way that you would compute thermal fluctuations scattering off your external potential. So the only difference here is that we just have, in some sense, a virtual population of phonons. Maybe that's probably not the right way of saying it, but we have this population of phonons that exist even at zero temperature, and this is what also will scatter. So that's basically the argument. There is some subtlety in the sense that this classical field is also modified. This classical field obeyed by this Gospodievsky equation is also modified from these fluctuations, and so one needs to self-consistently compute this too, which one can do. So does everybody understand sort of the basic thing now? So now everything is well defined now, right? So we have a scattering problem. We have an object here. We need to solve the Gross-Pediewski equation first, which has been solved by many people before us. They show that there's no drag force, and then we need to in some ways expand around this GPE. Solve these Bogle-Bodegin equations, which is.
Did you say that the excitation of this virtual phonons, mm-hmm. Bogle-Bodegin phonons, it's enough to have a non-zero drag at T0 and critical velocity 0?
Yes. So this would happen only in the Li and Yang order. You don't need to go to the higher order. You don't need to have the quasi-particles interact like the Bliv and Lehenau terms. So this happens at this Li and Yang order. Well, okay, so to be precise, we have a drag force at
dissipation.
Okay, dissipation. I'll argue, but what we've computed is a drag force on this object. And I'll argue more of a hint. Sure, okay. But what we've computed is an infinitely extended condensate. If you assume the incident waves are the non-perturbed waves, that you get a drag force from this here. Is it clear?
This is basically the one loop approximation. Mm-hmm. Basically, you are including the one loop correct, right? You do the fluctuation.
Right. Right. But the key thing is that, I mean, if it wasn't a quantum operator, then you would not get these. You would not get any drag, because the fact that this is a quantum operator gives you this virtual population here. So it's not. It's you can't just treat this. or unless you cheat a little bit, you can't just treat this as a classical field equation, expand around it, and get the same result. You really have to make sure that you keep this, the fact that this is truly a quantum operator. But you can derive these, and in fact, this is what Pitiyevsky did, and Gross and Pitiyevsky did in the early 60s. They get identical equations to this if you expand around the classical equation. But okay. Hopefully I haven't confused everybody so far. So first we'll talk about this this quasi-1D system. I mentioned it's not 1D in the sense of Liebig-Linegar 1D. It's quasi-1D. You have a cigar-shaped condensate, so your atoms can move around in three dimensions. It's just your transverse directions are frozen out. And in this case, you can actually solve, you can, as I mentioned before, you can solve the Gross-Pitiyevsky equation exactly in terms of soliton solutions. You can map the soliton solutions on together and actually I have a picture of this, I think. Yeah, this unfortunately didn't come out. So on the Gross-Pitiyevsky level, you have a moving delta function. So we're just assuming we have a point impurity in 1D. And on the Gross-Pitiyevsky level, you can map two solitons onto each other, and you can solve this problem exactly on subcritical velocities. And the thing that you see is that you get, even though that it's moving through your fluid, you get a symmetric perturbation. Right, and that's why there's no force. So the symmetric perturbation follows this object.
What's eta?
Eta is just your strength of your point impurity. So, well, as I'll show 3D results later, but we'd have to assume that we have a weak point impurity in 3D. We have to do Born approximation to solve this. In 1D, we can solve all of this exactly. And the amazing thing is that you can actually solve these Bogle-Bov-Dejean equations exactly in 1D. It was amazing to me. And this wasn't actually done by us. This was done by some, I forget their names now, some Chinese folks in the late 90s in terms of square jaw solutions. So this is the picture, and this is all done with Andrew, the grad student from the University of Queensland. This is the picture we have in mind. We have some incoming wave. That's this non-perturbed wave from that's coming in. And then we have four modes that scatter from these Bogle-Bov-Dejean equations. And we have to be very careful on which, you know, what waves catch up with the object and not, so forth. Unfortunately, this doesn't come out. So here are some, these are some of the preliminary results in 1D, because we haven't computed this modification to the classical field yet. But what you get, and I'll show the 3D solutions in the next slide, but what you get is, the important point I wanted to show is that you get a force at all velocities. And this is in terms of temperature, and you would expect a force that would decrease linearly at high enough temperatures. And the big point we're making is that it doesn't actually go to zero, it actually goes to some finite result. And at 3D, you can actually compute this. You'd have to assume that this point impurity in 3D is weak to do Born approximation, and then you can show that the force, of course, is going to be proportional to this dilutiveness parameter, which we have to assume to be small for all this to work, for all Bogle-Lyubov to work. We have to assume everything is dilute. So this is, and on and condensate experiments, this is on the order of 0.01 or something like this. But the amazing thing is they can tune this. They have a knob, and they can actually make this as big. Well, they can't make it too big because your condensate explodes. But they can, with Feshbach resonances, they can tune the scattering length. And it's proportional to velocity. But again, the important point is that there is a force at all velocities, all subcritical velocities.
So you are using this scattering analogy to get this result?
Well, it's not really hopefully it's not an analogy anymore. We're using the scattering problem we're solving the scattering problem. We're solving, and we have all the scattered amplitudes.
And the dispersion relations in the absence of this is?
It's Bogle-Lyubov.
So if you were to just use, and it has Bogle-Lyubov as the linear part, and then the
free particle.
Right. If you were to approximate it just with the linear part, would you still get this?
Yes. Yeah, I would believe so. I mean, I haven't actually computed it, but I would believe so. I don't think the non, I don't think the high, the free particle spectrum is.
What's the difference with electromagnetism?
The difference between electromagnetism is that I don't think you have any. Well, first of all, the Bogle-Bobb-Dejean equations are very different scattering. I mean, it's a very different structure than the electromagnetic case, right? I mean, this is not.
Linear theory isn't also linear dispersion relation. Is it equivalent to some relativistic theory?
Is it equivalent to some relativistic theory? I don't know, actually. I mean, it seems to me that. The Bogle-Bobb-Dejean equations, the structure is of complete difference to the electromagnetic case, but I don't know if this is in some ways that you can map this into some electromagnetic case. But the electromagnetic case, I mean, certainly you would have only two modes coming out, right? So there's something very different happening. This is right.
In case of the mass, you don't, right?
Yeah, but I don't think if you just make a mass a electromagnetic field with mass that you would still get anywhere close to this type of analysis. I mean, I don't think so. But I mean, perhaps someone else.
I'm saying if you make it linear dispersion relation, then there should be some kind of linear correlation.
Right.
Trying to see.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point, actually. No, we haven't actually tested the robustness from the dispersion relation. Let me try to think. Yeah, I'm not sure. Because at least in the 3D case here, it's actually the higher modes that are most relevant, that dominate this force. So there might be something subtle going on that I don't understand there. But we haven't actually tested the robustness of the dispersion relation.
Is it because of the critical velocity that you...
Critical velocity is zero.
There's a critical velocity on the Gross-Piderewski level. And so there would certainly still be a critical velocity to first approximation in experiments, too, because the Gross-Piderewski level is going to be enormous compared to this force, right? So you would certainly see some huge jump at a velocity. The only the thing that we're arguing is that below this velocity, there's going to be a little bit of drag force there.
So then, how is this compatible with Landau argument?
With Landau argument, this is exactly what I was getting to. So, okay. Well, first of all, I mean, what the entire Landau argument is. And it's something that you can argue with. It's a very powerful argument, is that to create excitations at zero temperature, you need a certain critical speed, depending on the dispersion relation, right? And this is, we're not creating any excitations. In fact, we're forcing no excitations to be created. We're at sort of this zero temperature in quotes, because this is a scattering problem. So we're not creating excitations, we're scattering, we're allowing these unperturbed states to scatter, right? And if you did this exact same formalism and create excitations, you would need some critical velocity to do this. So this is not saying that somehow Landau's argument was incorrect. It's just a different mechanism that's there. So if you allow, so perhaps it's perhaps this if you would allow thermal phonons in your gas, then I think everybody would agree that you can have a drag force at any velocity, because thermal phonons can transfer momentum, right? And if you actually compute how they do this and how they do the drag forces, it's exactly this problem. You have to set up some scattering problem. It's if you wanted to do it with a Bogle-Bobb gas, you'd have to solve these equations, right? And the only difference is that your initial population, instead of being these phonons, these finite temperature phonons, you get these virtual phonons because you've normal ordered your operators and you get these Li and Yang correction. So we're not saying that Landau was incorrect by any means. It's just a different mechanism. So, okay. So there's lots of things that bother me. When I first actually got into this problem, what I was interested in a few years ago was that I was assuming that this was going to be zero, and I was really interested to see how this conspiracy of cancellation happened, because you have all these fluctuations coming on one side that have to exactly cancel with the other side, and so there would be this really mysterious cancellation. I was interested in seeing, and after lots of yelling and arguing and stuff with Eve over many months, that I think we convinced ourselves that this is consistent with everything we knew about superfluids. And one of the things that bothered us most was this idea of persistent currents, right? So this is one of the better tested things in all of physics, but certainly in superfluids, is you have this Repi's experiment that this superfluid would go around for practically ever. And if we're arguing that there's some, even a little bit of drag, this seems to contradict it. And we haven't proven this argument yet, but this is what we think that's happening. This is what Matt Davis, University of Queensland, is trying to simulate. But what we think is going on is the following. So what we've computed is a drag force in an infinitely extended condensate. Of course, in a persistent current, you're in a finite geometry. It's a very different scattering problem. And so what we believe to happen, maybe I can write this down. So, okay. So now I can, since I'm not being taped over here, I can say different things. So let's just imagine that we have some toroidal geometry and we have a persistent current going around. And let's just imagine that everything's frictionless here. Okay, so this will go on. So it wouldn't need to be frictionless in general, but let's just imagine everything's frictionless. And all our friction is going to be in a nail in the middle of this donut with the fluid going around. Right? So what we've argued and what we believe showed that is that in an infinitely extended condensate and an infinitely extended superfluid, there'll be drag. And so initially, when you have these unperturbed states scatter from this object, initially this object will think it's in an infinitely extended condensate for a certain time scale until the waves come back and reinteract with this object. So if you write down the force as a function of time. If you assume that this Casimir drag doesn't exist, which you would expect if I have a fluid and I just knocked in a nail, there's going to be some ringing, of course, because I perturbed the system, and then it should go down to zero. That's what, without this Casimir. And what we're saying is there's going to be some ringing, and then there's going to be some time scale, depending on the length of the system over the speed of sound. And then it goes down to zero. So what happens is that as these waves scatter, eventually they'll come back and reinteract, which is a very different scattering problem, right? And when they come back and reinteract, eventually they'll cancel out. And what we believe is happening is that at higher order terms, everything here is on the Li and Yang order, right? So at higher order terms, these Bolyai and Landau terms, when you allow quasi-particles to interact, you can start talking about equilibrium again, thermal equilibrium, because you're allowing things to interact. And so these scattered waves would relax to some new, at least local thermal equilibrium. And when it relaxed to this new thermal equilibrium, there'll be a small amount of normal gas produced from this friction. And a small amount of normal gas that's produced will exactly cancel this thing out. So it'll keep creating the scattered waves until it cancels out this friction. And so this is something that we haven't actually shown yet. Well, the numerical simulation that Matt is doing is that quantum optics people have very powerful techniques to solve these types of equations, these Gospodarevsky equations and Bogle-Bogdan equations. And he's using this truncated Wigner approximation to simulate exactly this. Because if you have rescattering, it's as you can imagine, it's a very difficult problem. But there are some predictions from this, and now since we have these new experiments and the condensates, we can test this. There's a new time scale, and there should be at least a certain amount of thermal gas that is produced by this. And so these new experiments that have been done, Los Alamos and NIST and so forth, they've actually seen these persistent currents. And so the idea is just to put a little laser beam in this persistent current. It'll be a difficult experiment, but it's at least in principle able to be seen.
It sounds a bit like, with your explanation, you could
I mean, it sounds that it can explain, like you could predict that everything will be.
So the question is how much normal fluid.
The system is closed and so. I'm just saying that this argument seems kind of fishy in the sense that. With this kind of argument, you can show that any kind of fluid will continue rotating because you're just saying, okay, the system is closed, things
right.
come back and turn around.
And also, the biggest weakness is how much normal fluid is produced to counteract this. I mean, this is why, and we haven't been able to do this. This is why I'm working with Matt. All right, this is what we think that's happening. This seems to be consistent with all the constraints of the problem, but. I think within a few months we should be able to see this numerically. Yes.
Can you interpret this dissipation in terms of the viscosity?
Yeah, that's much more difficult. I mean, we haven't computed a viscosity. I mean, all we've computed here is a drag, and it should be related, but.
One would think that the concept of velocity is much more generalizable and obtainable from underlying field theory concepts than the drag on a particular object in a particular geometry. I mean, aren't you saying that these condensates possess an inherent viscosity that you could, in principle, calculate from first principles?
I don't know if I want to go so far. I mean.
Let's put it this way, if viscosity was zero, is this consistent with the flow with zero viscosity?
Is this consistent? It depends what you mean. I mean, if you consider this a flow with zero viscosity, then I would say this is consistent with a flow with zero viscosity. But the only difference between the flow with and without this drag is there would be a small amount of normal fluid would be there or not, right? But there would still be a flow that would be going on forever in this persistent current experiment. If you have a flow it's a very different scattering problem if you have some rough wall or something that you need to scatter off of, you know, or you have a flow through a pipe or something, which I assume that you're envisioning. Where would the viscosity?
In terms of the Kubo formula for the viscosity can be computed directly from this correlation of the stress tensor.
Right.
Without reference to any particular rough surface or anything.
The short answer is I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, this is something Eve and I have discussed before, and I don't know. I mean, I think we're reasonably confident in this drag calculation. I think it seems to make sense to us. And to generalize this to viscosity, it's much more difficult. And I don't have a good understanding of this. So I would be certainly happy to hear this. But we've had lots of heated discussions on this stuff. But as I'm sure anybody who knows Eve in this audience right now. Before I finish, I've gone a little bit too far, but before I finish, there was, speaking of rough surfaces, Eve and I was talking exactly about this viscosity problem. We never really could make too much progress on it, but we did come up with an argument that I think that makes sense when this flow goes by a rough surface. And it's this idea that there's a certain amount of superfluid that is being converted into normal fluid. It's this idea that I was talking about with higher order terms that relaxes this to a normal fluid. And this gives you a new hydrodynamic boundary condition on a rough surface, and it's depending upon this velocity. So as I mentioned, that there seems to be on an object and a slow-moving superfluid, and an infinitely extended condensate, if you introduce these quantum fluctuations, that there is a drag at all velocities. And if this operator was not quantum, they wouldn't be there. So this seemed to have some profound effects at low velocities. And of course, this is the dominant effect because the huge condensate effect, this Gross-Podievsky effect, does not give you a drag force here. The first few times I gave this talk, a lot of people kept asking about BCS fluids, and which is a related, but it's a different type problem. Of the Bogle-Degen equations, the name Degen comes from because he was interested in superconductors and just these types of things. And recently, Rishi Sharma and I have started exploring this problem with BCS. This is the what I've been working on here, and we've made some progress. We still haven't sorted this out, but we made a bit of progress. There's some similarities and differences. Well, we've been making progress before Tuesday, and then after the election, it's been not much progress made. But hopefully some progress will start up again. But this is a way to see this transition in the condensates. This would be one of the few ways to actually pinpoint the superfluid mod insulator transition. As I mentioned, that there's these toroidal trap experiments that's just come online in the last year or so, and they can actually change their geometry. They can make it, you know, much bigger. They can double the size, so they can directly test this effect. The problem, of course, is how big is this guy here? And this is what the numerics hopefully will show us soon. And for those aficionados in the audience, just to make something even more controversial, there's this very controversial force in the superfluids called the Yordansky force. And this usually gets people throwing tomatoes at each other and stuff. So what Yordansky theorized in the late 60s is in a moving vortex, thermal fluctuations that scatter off this moving vortex, there should be some drag force due to this, some perpendicular drag force due to this. And from the latest I've seen, Sonnen agrees with this and Taulis doesn't. And it's not so clear if this exists or not. And I certainly don't want to say that, especially on TV, I'm not going to say whether it exists or not. But having talked to Len Piesman recently, with the structure of these equations, if there's a Yordansky force at finite temperature, which is just thermal fluctuations bouncing off vortices causing a drag force, there should also be a zero temperature Yordansky force exactly due to this effect. Right. The problem is, the reason why this force is controversial for the last 50 years is a very, very difficult calculation. Vortices, scattering of vortices is a real problem because vortices have these long-range effects and you have to be very careful and things like that. But anyway, just to make things a bit more controversial. So I'll stop there and take questions. Thanks. Seems to be broken here.
May I repeat my question?
Okay.
Now you know the feelings that are coming to you. It's still at the very beginning.
So as I told, this kind of dispersion law, it's typical for any liquid. Just this guy is precursor of crystallization.
Right.
The same true for helium-4, by the way. Mm. And the specific feature of helium, superfluid helium, that this excitation, no broadening. It's just sharp excitation, no imaginary part. It's only real part. Apparently, what you said, that there is broadening due to this fluctuations, I don't know, excitation of virtual phonons. Apparently, you told that there is some broadening, even in superfluid helium. I could accept that broadening might appear here at finite Q.
Right.
But
well,
never in this region. So if you replace by linear dispersion, I'm pretty sure you should.
Right. Well, first of all, I think I must have implied something wrong. We're not dealing with this system at all. What we're dealing with only is the weakly interacting.
Yes,
so
right,
we don't have any
thinking about okay. Real helium. How this drag force could appear in real helium?
Right. So
T0, it's very small thing.
You would imagine, I mean, first the caveat is that this theory Gross-Pitiyevsky plus Bogliubov and so forth is very much a dilute theory. So you cannot directly apply this to helium. But you would imagine that, you know, there should be some analogy there. And at least after the question, at least in the 3D Born approximation that we did in the force, the high modes dominate. So, but I don't know the robustness to the dispersion. It's a good question. It's something that would probably...
High modes, no. I mean, you must have a scale.
Yeah, you have a cutoff scale that's due to the width of your object. So it actually diverges as the log, but if it diverges the log because I have a delta function as my object. If you make the width of your object have some finite length, that's the scale that you cut off. But this is not, I'm sorry. This is not in 1D. This was in the 3D Born approximation case.
But this is a data function potential that you first broaden, make test functions calculation. Data function by test function.
Right.
The finite size.
That's
the cutoff.
Right. You get those logs.
The nodes are of that cutoff.
Right.
So are you saying that the bigger objects will have less drag?
Bigger object will have less drag. No, I don't think I'm saying that. How would you have gotten that?
Well, if you're saying that the higher modes are the important ones.
Keep in mind that the size of the object, this is probably confusing things. The strength of the object is assumed, at least in the 3D case, to be very weak, so we could do Born approximation, right? So we say we have a delta function, but we have some strength of that delta function. We have to assume that that's very weak, so we can expand around that, right? In 3D, in the quasi 1D case, we can solve that exactly. So in the 3D case, we can't say anything about how the size depends on it, because we're only doing a weak point of view. We're only doing this. The strength of the delta function has to be very, very small. Right, so it makes sense.
Your scattering calculation that you presented was slightly black boxish. Could you once more explain which part of the scattering was responsible for this effect? The appearance of this.
So what's happening, what's the important thing here is that the force, you can think of this force coming, if you do this at zero temperature. Actually you swept a lot of the details under the rug. And if you guys are interested, perhaps we can talk about it later, but from this term here, we can just forget about this term, this contributes on the same order. From this term here, this gives this type of thing, and if you assume a delta function, you just have to take a derivative at x equals zero. So you're basically just taking the density difference on either side of this object, which is giving you, in some sense, the thermal density, the virtual photon density at t equals zero. And so now to compute these quasi-particle amplitudes, these equations is what these quasi-particle amplitudes have to obey. So this is what's defining our scattering problem, right? So we have two second order equations, right? And we have a scattering problem given by the following. We have some incident wave that's given by what we know we can compute. This is just a Bogdanov-Galilean transform homogeneous gas. And then we have four modes from these equations that we can compute. You have two evanescent waves, a transmitted wave, and a reflected wave. It's all going to depend on this flowing. The reason why there's a drag force is because, of course, you have incident waves coming from this side too, but there's a symmetry broken because your flow is moving at a certain velocity. So all these modes depend on this velocity. And so what you need to do is you need to integrate over all these modes that actually reach this, that are going downstream, minus all the modes that are coming from this side, and see if there's a difference or not. And we argue that there is. And we also argue that this is the exact same calculation that you would need to do for a thermal gas, if you were to compute the drag from the thermal, except instead of something like this, you would add some thermal distribution of phonons here. So I don't know if that helped at all, but in principle, this is now a well-defined problem. So you have a scattering problem, you have an observable, and now you can compute it. So, and as I argued, at least analytically, you can compute this in Born approximation in higher dimensions, or you can actually amazingly solve this exactly in 1D. Or if you're these really smart Chinese folks that I forget their names, you can solve in 1D.
So. Evanescence modes, is this important or unimportant?
This is unimportant, actually. Because you can actually, the equivalent of the force here, that we're computing basically the density on each side of this, we can also compute the stress tensors at infinity, right? So we can compute the difference of the stress tensor there and stress tensor there, and you should get the exact same result. And so the evanescent waves go around, so you only should depend on these reflected and transmitted waves, only the ones that go away for our to infinity.